supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. My guess is that divorce among older couples is not something we collectively see as norm in our culture. We tend not to expect it, but it is happening, and it's happening increasingly. Divorce rate among those 50 and older has more than doubled in the last 20 years. Studies show that couples who've been in long, unhappy marriages are more likely to consider divorce than their parents or grandparents, certainly. Although also a growing number of elderly couples are in their second marriages or even third marriages, and those marriages are even more likely to end in divorce. In some circles, this new group of divorced men and women has earned the nickname Silver Splitters. And on today's show, we'll address what they're going through. And we'll talk about ways to preserve marital relationships later in life. I've got two guests on my show. Rita DiMaria is a couples and family therapist here locally. She's a director of the relationship education at the Marriage Council. She's co-authored The Seven Stages of Marriage. Rita, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dan. I'm glad to be here.
And Scott Hartzman is a geriatric psychiatrist, distinguished fellow with the American Psychiatric Association. He's written a number of books, including The Secrets of Happy Families, 8 Keys to Building a Lifetime of Connection and Contentment. Scott, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be on with you and Rita, Dan.
And we'd like to hear from you, of course. Our number is 888-477-9499. Are you a silver splitter, or are you 50 or older and considering divorce, or have considered it? Also, I'd like to hear from adult children whose parents may have divorced in later life. We'd like to hear what it was like for you. Let's start with you, Scott. We in this country have the highest divorce rate in the world. We've got about 45% are expected to end in divorce. And that rate has remained stable over the last 30 years. But the elderly proportion, like I said, has been doubled. I know nobody knows exactly why for sure, but can you offer a guess as to how and why this is happening?
Well, as someone who practices geriatric psychiatry and sees a lot of folks that are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, a lot of us assume that this is the help I've fallen but I can't get up generation. But in fact, they're the generation of Mick Jagger and Carly Simon and the Beatles. This was a very progressive group of folks in their day that had a lot of ideas about individual happiness and finding their inner sense of well-being, and that's one of the reasons that the divorce rates had spiked so dramatically in the late 70s and up until the mid 80s. And now these folks are older, but they're still holding on to some of these same values that they deserve to be happy. And when the marriage is not going well and they are having difficulties, their first thought is, well, because I deserve to be happy and I'm not happy now, maybe if I leave this marriage, I'll be able to find more happiness. Well, so these are the folks that brought divorce into our culture, and they're the folks that are still doing it.
Rita, I've counseled a lot of people, and in this stage, dealing with marital difficulties, and, their expectations of their lives, the longevity of their lives are quite different. So, they hit 50, and I hear more than once I've heard people say, do I want to spend the next 30 years of my life with this person?
Yes, I think you're making a very important point about the change in expectations. I do agree with Scott that, you know, people have a desire for personal satisfaction and fulfillment today that is very different from previous generations. But I think the point about the change of expectations and standards, with the change in roles between men and women from the 80s and onward, and the balance and the expectations of mutual satisfaction, I think that some of the marriages that don't attend to the needs of both people over the course of time, because you never can have equal balance, of course, is really important. And many people struggle with that. And then they wake up one day and they kind of look each other and say, what's been going on here? I want more out of life.
I do have to tell you, I had a really interesting experience. When was it? Just a few days ago, I was in an elevator at the Shore, and a woman gets on with me, and she was wearing work clothes. You know, she had clearly been working that day. And I said to her, I said, looks like you work today. And she said, yeah. And I said, that's never a good idea, especially when you're at the Shore. And she says, well, tell me about it. She said, you know, 5 years ago, I had the idea that it would be great to be an independent woman. She said, and now I know that wasn't such a good idea. I was impressed with her candor.
Right. Well, there is that challenge, you know, changing a lifestyle with a person you've spent your life with, especially if you basically had a fairly good spark of love, as I would call it, in the beginning of the relationship, and you've attended to your relationship somewhat over the years, the challenges of making those lifestyle changes are far greater than most people anticipate. And, you know, it's an interesting part of this. Some of those couples may get divorced, but, you know, there is that small group, and we don't talk about them at all, that small group who actually get back together, because after the time apart, sometimes if neither one of them have found another person that they have fallen in love with, you know, they kind of look at each other and say, well, what did we do here? That's been a fascinating experience that I've had. But I do think, you know, the dimensions of life are complicated and people make choices. And when we feel like we've missed out, or we've been hurt by certain experiences in our relationship, you know, from infidelity, financial problems, problems with children, young adult children, small children, health issues. Sometimes it just brings people to a place where they say to themselves, you know, what do I really want out of the next 20, 30 years? Because the reality is we are living longer. You know, recently an insurance agent told me that I needed a new life insurance policy because I really had a very good chance of living beyond 100. And, you know, that's not what my mother faced, for sure.
And after all, if you live beyond 100, your 80-year-old children are going to definitely want some of that pot when you go.
Yes.
Scott,
yes,
what actually did you mean by pot? I want some of that. Because, you know,
well,
we're talking about generational issues. Scott, you know,
yes.
a colleague of mine, I once told a couple I sent her way that this couple would have three marriages in their lives. And, you know, one marriage was the romantic, one was to procreate and raise children, and the other was post-children. And she said they could decide if it was going to be with the same partner or not.
Well, I think that's very poetic and probably very reflective of the changes that people go through. As you pointed out, Rita's book, The Seven Stages of Marriage, talks about some of those transitions. And I think what I would say is you actually don't have a choice because you will have a different partner. They just may have the same DNA and social security number.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because people will change. And the person that you married, for all of their qualities, is going to have some fundamental differences if you're lucky enough to be with that person 50, 60, or 70 years later. Okay. And, Dan, I wanted to go back to one of the things that you spoke about in terms of the woman on the elevator who had declared that maybe it wasn't such a great idea to be an independent contractor. Because I think that's a really good metaphor for the one of the biggest challenges to marriage, which is that the dependency that traditionally women would have on the income of a man so that she could define her role as being a caretaker or a homemaker, that model has basically gone out the window. So that while there still are a number of women who are dependent on men financially, there's no expectation that they can't make it out there on their own. And so I think that's been one of the major shifts that's led to divorce since the 70s, is the idea that there's the idea that women are no longer dependent on men, and women are not happy with the quality of the relationship. So studies are showing that women, more than men, about 2 out of 3, if not more, of all marriages that end in divorce, the divorce is precipitated by the woman.
I think, Dan, also speaks to, you said it was an interesting also about that woman, the post-children, I don't know what that third stage was, which sounds awfully dry and boring and not exciting at all. And I do believe that people, even as they get older, really like to be in love, and they enjoy romantic love. It's not that that's just a once-and-done stage of life. And, you know, the new neuroscience studies actually show that the couples who know how to work that chemistry in their relationship over time actually have more vital areas of their brain still firing up, and actually it exceeds that of couples who have just fallen in love.
I want to get to that later in the show, exactly how that's done. I know that's one of the areas of your expertise. That was Rita DeMaria. She's a psychologist and couples and family therapist and director of relationship education at the Council for Relationships. Scott Hartzman is a geriatric psychiatrist. Both have published books on this topic. We're talking about silver splitters, divorcing when you are 50 and post 50. Scott, I was just in South Africa, and saw a lot of animals, heard a lot about animal behaviors. We were in the Zulu territory. We heard from a lot of traditional Zulu tribes. And I found that monogamy is pretty unnatural in nature. Polygamy is the norm. Not that I recommend it, but, you know, in nature, polygamy is the norm. So are we forcing ourselves to do something that might be not in our evolutionary genes?
Well, Dan, you mentioned my book, The Secrets of Happy Families, and my most recent book is The Secrets of Surviving Infidelity. And it's exactly this issue which I address in the early parts of the book, is that whether you're in Africa or whether you're outside in the backyard looking in the lawn at beetles and insects, monogamy is a relatively rare in mammals, in vertebrates. We think that it may only be about 4 or 5%, and only one other species of primates has monogamy. So,
what is that?
You may be right. It may be something that is not biologically natural. But I don't. To me, we still make lots of choices as humans, and we set up society as humans based on a lot of things that aren't biologically natural. You know, stopping at a red light at an intersection isn't biologically natural, nor for that matter is wearing clothes. But we often do it as part of a social network and framework. And I think what I've been convinced about in the years that I've been doing marriage research is the tremendous benefits to children and to society and to individuals who choose to marry. So, you know, my view is that people are choosing to marry, so I want to do everything in my ability as a doctor to help these people have as healthy and as fulfilling and maintain their marriages, if at all possible.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. We've got Susan on the line from Pomona. Hi, Susan.
Hey, I would just like to say I'm 64. My husband's 69. We have been married over 40-some years, raised a family. And then I had the empty nest syndrome, which is really tough for a mom, as we all know. And I became very dissatisfied with staying where we're from, which is in central Pennsylvania. I found wonderful jobs here in New Jersey. And I live in New Jersey during the week. My husband has a job in Harrisburg. And my commitment to our marriage is I come home every weekend. And I feel like I'm 25. Our marriage has brought fresh vitality to it. And my mindset the whole time when I contemplated this was, I can't do this. I'm not allowed to do this. I have to stay put. This is not what you do. But I love my husband. I love my marriage. And I didn't want to leave that. But I have to be happy. I had to be fulfilled. And so for me, this is kind of how I worked everything out. So it's been great so far.
And you and your husband are both happy.
He's very happy, too. He works very hard. And I don't think he'll ever retire. He's an old-time family doctor who loves helping people. Mm. And so it gives him the freedom, which I think is really important in a marriage, to be who he is and have his self fulfilled. And yet I'm allowed that same freedom within the confines of a marriage. It probably sounds really obscure, but it's working for us anyway. So I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Curious if, Scott, you have any thoughts about what Susan...
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, this is the type of scenario that could have very well been a phone call saying, I needed something different in my life, I needed to go in a new direction, so I got a divorce. And the difference between Susan and so many other people that I deal with is that she was able to say, I need something different in my life, but I'm going to try to work on it within my commitment to be married, within all the benefits that marriage brings me. So I'm going to be able to be happy and be married. And so many times people believe, and the studies don't show this, people believe they can either be happy or be married. And what Susan is showing is you can be happy and be married if you're creative about it.
That's the issue, and that's what I have found with couples I've worked with over, you know, 35 years, that good marriages, all good relationships, are about creativity. It's not a zero-sum game. It's about creativity. Susan, thanks so much for your call, and I wish you the best. Welcome to New Jersey. We're going to take a short break. We've got lots more to talk about, and I want to talk about prevention and remediation. There's also, Scott, you pointed out that the highest number of people who are unfaithful are in their 60s. So we've got to talk about that also. We're talking about, quote, silver splitters, people who are divorcing or divorced in their 50s and beyond. We're talking with psychologist Rita DeMaria, who's a therapist at the Relationship Center, and her book, she co-authored The Seven Stages of Marriage. Scott Holtzman is a geriatric psychiatrist. He's the author of many books, including Secrets of Surviving Infidelity and Secrets of a Happy Family. We'd love to hear from you if you're in your 50s or beyond and are considering divorce or are unhappy in your marriage. We'd love to hear from you if you decided to stay in a marriage that after a struggle. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
One in three families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about separation and divorce post 50 with geriatric psychiatrist Scott Holtzman and psychologist, couples and family therapist Rita DeMaria. Rita, you wrote a blog called Another Shade of Gray. Very clever, by the way. One of the implications of the articles that couples should address whatever issues are pulling them apart right away rather than at age 50 or 60 saying, I'm miserable, I'm leaving.
Right. Well, I have called that empty nest age, renamed that reunion. It's a time for couples to come back together. And that's what the previous caller was talking about, I believe, when she said that she made that commitment. So the prevention part of that is in reunion, and people don't like this part, but it is absolutely necessary, which is, you know, emptying out the old baggage and revisiting it and making peace with it so that you can move on and be more current and more tuned into each other now that it's the two of you again, whether the children come back or not. So, and then moving from there into the later stage, which will be completion or contentment as people try to figure out what they're going to do in their life. But it requires communication, which is always the case. But for couples who have been together, the level of communication helps them to reveal more of a sense of vulnerability. And I like some of the research that's coming out now that says that the more vulnerable you are with someone, the closer and more emotionally connected you're going to be. And whole point about monogamy, really, monogamy comes from the bond, the emotional and physical bond. And I like to think of the sexuality piece as being the, you could call it the icing on the cake, but the bond in human beings is very unique to the whole animal kingdom.
Yeah, this research stems from Brené Brown, who's been a guest on our show, and I think this whole business of vulnerability and especially our fear of our own vulnerability does lead to more isolation and loneliness and probably a lot of discord in marriages too. Scott, you know, I mentioned this research that you cited about the highest number of people who are unfaithful being in their 60s. And you say that every year you stay married, your risk for infidelity increases. That, you know, that's a little depressing and gets back to my original question about monogamy being unnatural.
Well, I want to qualify that a bit, Dan. It sounds pretty dramatic.
Please, because I increased my medication after I read that.
I think the issue here is that the risk of anything happening to you goes up the longer you live. So that what's the risk that you're going to have an infidelity on the first day of your marriage? Well, relatively low, although it happens. Within the first week, within the first month, within the first year. So part of that is just a statistical aberration, which is to say the longer you live, the more the overall chance that at some point in your life you'll have had some experience, and that experience will include infidelity. But I think the point when this study was done, and that's about 10 years ago that this study was done, is we would expect that there was a certain kind of generational cutoff at which certain people never would have had affairs. But it certainly looked like the people that were still married in their 60s were able to look back and say, yeah, over at some point in my life, about 25-28% of men had had an affair, and about 15% of women had had an affair. And if you look at that statistics for younger people, like in their 40s or in their 30s, that would be a smaller percentage.
You, I want to follow up on that infidelity issue, because people don't divorce because of infidelity. They divorce because they can't tolerate the pain that goes with it and the betrayal. So how do we help?
Well, you can't separate infidelity from the pain or betrayal.
It's
a package. Unless you've determined that you're going to go into marriage with an open relationship, at which point it's infidelity is, you know, not a betrayal because everybody knows it's happening. So there's a lot of emotional baggage that goes along with an affair. I agree with that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's the emotions that are intolerable, and that's the word that breaks up marriages after an affair. It's something feels intolerable, but is it truly intolerable? Tell me about your book, Scott. You wrote about the secrets of surviving infidelity.
Absolutely. So and I would say that it feels intolerable. But as any good cognitive, behaviorally right. oriented psychotherapist will tell you, just because something feels intolerable
right.
Doesn't mean that it is intolerable. It's just how it feels.
Right.
And I think what happens is most people will say to themselves before they get married, if my partner ever had an affair on me, I would be out in a New York second. I would just be gone. But then what happens is in reality, it does happen. And unfortunately, it happens more than we would like to admit. And then it really does, it kind of opens up all kinds of things, including the emotional impact. People need to reexamine the relationship. They have to take a good look at their spouse, and undoubtedly they have to deal with the fact that they have been betrayed. Now, in some cases, it can open up a dialogue, and people can begin to learn ways to rebuild the relationship, because most people assume that the person that has an affair is just someone who's just an evil or bad person, has no conscience. But most people that have affairs, they themselves would say that they would never have imagined that they would have been involved in an affair.
Right.
They get involved in this infidelity and often don't even know how to get themselves out. So couples can work together to get through infidelity, as intolerable as it feels when it gets discovered.
Right. Rita, you want to make one last comment about this, and then we'll go to the phones.
Sure. I think that a lot of people will talk about, when they get to this crisis, how much pain they were in before the affair started. And it's often on both people's part, but certainly for the person who finds themselves suddenly, from their point of view, in the midst of an affair that they never believed that they would be capable of. But there's a tremendous amount of pain that is present before affairs happen, and couples not only have to work through the pain of the affair, but they have to work through the pain of what was happening in their marriage before the affair.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Will on the line. Hi, Will. Will?
Hi, Dan. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
This is a fascinating and very close to home subject for me, and you're adding Brené Brown to the mix. I just sent two friends of mine, you know, links to her videos this morning. I think they're just tremendous. And I can't find anything wrong in her reasoning or her research. I am 58, separated 3 years ago on the eve of our 25th anniversary. We have three sons. And I had posed the question on the way to a summer vacation to my wife. I posed that the marriage was very ill and neither of us were getting what we wanted, and were we going to do something to try to work this out, or were we going to give up on it? And the response that I got from her was so noncommittal that I pretty much knew the answer then. And as it turned out, about 2 years later, in a conversation we had where she sort of laid out all her grievances with me, there was a single sexual encounter I had with somebody in our second year of marriage that was, you know, a very, it was pure sex only, was a one-time thing, and my reservations about getting married, which I expressed to her, was that it was tough for me to imagine having a single sexual partner. Both of us had been very active prior to being married. We didn't marry till we were 30 and 31, and we made a deal at that point, or at least I thought we had made a deal, that if either of us got into an affair that threatened the marriage, we had to come to the other person with it. And if either of us asked the other about any kind of sexual encounter that we might have had or suspicion that they had, we had to answer honestly. So when she asked about the possibility of this encounter, I guess about 3 months after it happened, I told her the truth, in all respect. And I found out 2 years after we separated, in a very difficult conversation that we had, just the two of us, no therapist, I called it the Sunday afternoon massacre, because it was basically her talking about what I had done to destroy the marriage. I found out that she had been punishing me for that encounter for 23 years, 24 years, and had never said so. And she admitted, actually, in that diatribe that she was wrong, but I guess at that
point... Let me jump in here, because I'm looking on my board here, and Emily Haas, our production assistant, types in a summary of what you're going to talk about. And the last four words of her summary say, "But I miss her." Do you?
Yes, I do.
Yes,
I do. We talk all the time. You know, we're amicable. We still have Thanksgiving together with our sons, because I don't believe it's right for them to make them do two holidays because we can't be adults.
I'm anxious to hear Rita's reaction.
Well, memories are really just so intricately woven into our minds and our bodies. Physical memories of a person, their smell, their sound, their touch, the emotional memories that we have, the mental stimulation that we've had with them over the years. People just don't appreciate how much that grows over time. So when you've been with someone a long time, despite that pain, you know, I sometimes refer to that like the princess and the pea, like that was there all that time, aggravating the relationship without either person really understanding or knowing that that was something they needed to attend to. So, you know, building that kind of emotional intimacy and vulnerability in a marriage today is something that we in the field are starting to learn how powerful and important that is. But also keeping sexual passion alive, too, is a part of the formula that we don't often get to. But the memories, the power of those memories is tremendous. And we can nurture those old memories, and we can create new memories, and we can remain vital till the ends of our lives.
Well, thanks so much for your call. Scott, I want to follow up with you. You know, Rita used a phrase that these memories that neither is aware of. And, you know, that's what I'm seeing very often, is that people aren't aware of their low-grade unhappiness over the years. And they just carry it as norm.
Right, and when we look at what probably the best predictor of couples when they begin to drift apart and when they move toward divorce is resentment. Resentment being loosely defined as, I have defined my expectations for what you're going to bring to the table, and you have not brought that. And your inability to bring that to the table is a cause of emotional distress on my part. In Will's case, it was her perception of his inability to stay faithful. And I give Will credit, Will and his spouse, for making this deal early on. A lot of couples don't even discuss the possibility of infidelity. And I would say they just left out one part, which is to say that we need to be open and honest when it happens, and we need to try to work through it. The other partner can't, you know, the other partner can't hold on to this resentment and anger, because when that happens, it just shuts down. It shuts down both partners. One partner learns, I'm never going to tell the truth again. And the other partner just basically has develops a growing mistrust.
Yeah, I interviewed a learned man years ago, and he talked about resentment. He said resentment is like mud wrestling with a pig. He said, you'll both get dirty, but the pig's going to enjoy it.
And in human interactions, of course, resentment is it's a poison.
Of course,
and
it is.
The only way to overcome resentment is, and this is a pearl that Steve Stosny, a psychologist, frequently talks about, is to have compassion for that other person's point of view, and that's when I'm getting feedback about my book Secrets of Surviving Infidelity. From folks who have been victims of infidelity, they're appreciative that they're able to see what it's like for the person who's having an affair. Will needs some compassion, needs some empathy at this point. He wants to move on with his life, but his wife was stuck. That's where the resentment builds up.
I would go further and say, have compassion for the other person, but even for the person who's feeling resentment, have compassion for your own suffering. Resentment is just being reactive to pain. But, you know, you're suffering in there. And if you can let go of the resentment, you can really just feel the pain. And if you can feel compassion for that, it feels a little safer and you can move on.
Dan, I would say no secrets. You know, when our children are growing up, no secrets, no keeping secrets.
Good
bad
luck
things
with
can
that.
Happen. But in our grown-up life, we don't practice that. We want our children not to have secrets, you know, if something bad has happened. But the more we can have honesty and openness, and minimizing the secret holding and the secret keeping, which always will show up sooner or later in some form or another, couples are going to be closer and more connected and more committed and have a better friendship.
Yes, but the issue is that you have to have honesty on the one part, but that person who tells the honest reckoning of what's going on has to be met by acceptance on the part of the other.
Right,
so if I'm honest, every time I spend an extra nickel over our budget, and every time I spend a nickel over my budget, my spouse has goes on a rant for 3 days, then honesty doesn't work. So you have to be honesty, but the other person has to then be willing to accept that and work with it rather than react immediately.
Right, listen, ladies and gentlemen, we have a lot of callers. We got to take a break. We have a lot of callers, and I want to get to those calls. And I want to talk to both of you about what happens after divorce. Are people happier? What's the dating scene like? So we got a lot of work to do here. So let's take a break and get busy. My guests are Rita DeMaria. She's a couples and family therapist at the Relationship Center. She's co-author of Seven Stages of Marriage. Scott Holtzman is a geriatric psychiatrist, and his latest book is The Secrets of Surviving Infidelity. We're talking about divorce and separation in the silver years, 50 and beyond. We'd love to hear from you at 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Longs Park Amphitheater Foundation supports WHYY and presents the 35th annual Longs Park Art and Craft Festival. This fine art and craft show will be held rain or shine this Friday through Sunday in Lancaster's Longs Park. 210 fine artists and craftspeople have been chosen to exhibit from nearly 1,000 applicants. The show will feature an array of jewelry, apparel, paintings, ceramics, sculpture, and more. Tickets and details online at longspark.org.
The Independence Blue Cross Foundation is proud to support WHYY and the health and wellness of those in southeastern Pennsylvania. This year, the foundation is bringing its Healthy Futures Initiative to 20 area schools. The program teaches children to eat right, get fit, and stay well, and is focused on helping thousands of students and their families. By changing how kids think about nutrition, fitness, and wellness, Independence Blue Cross Foundation and its partners are offering a healthier future for our region. More information at ibxfoundation.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about silver splitters with family therapist Rita DeMaria, geriatric psychiatrist Scott Haltzman. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Helen on the line. Hi, Helen.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, it's fascinating. The topic is fascinating because I have just left my mother-in-law's funeral, and my husband and I are in the middle of a divorce. I'm 66, he's 62. And it's created a lot of turmoil in my life and a certain amount of ambivalence. I look at this man and I love him, but I can't trust him. So I can't be with him. It feels like I can't be with him. My family hates him. And it's a very painful place to be.
Can I ask you a question? You said you love him, but you don't trust him, and therefore you can't be with him.
Right.
What's that connection, that you don't trust him and therefore you can't be with him? Why do those two things have to necessarily be linked?
There's always been another woman, always, in our life. His old girlfriend created a lot of hardship for me personally. After we were married, and he's always been online looking up women. He is on AsianDating.com looking up women.
Let me suggest something to you, and I both of my guests today have talked about creativity in marriage or even in divorce. So let's put their creative minds together, and I have some thoughts myself. I'd really like to hear from both of you. Rita, Scott?
Well, I think that it's really important to acknowledge the bond that she feels in this relationship. But if this is a person who has been chronically untrustworthy, then you have to make really hard personal choices and decisions about how you're going to live your life with somebody that is going to be hurting you at that kind of level on a regular basis. But I think it speaks to the tenacity of the bonds that grow between people over time and what happens when people fall in love. But then we have to also say, let's look at where I am as a person and what I need and what I want in my life and how does this work? Because a sustainable relationship requires sharing and emotional intimacy. And if that's not something that's the other person's capable of and they're unwilling, if they're willing, that's one thing. But if they're unwilling to be open and be vulnerable, we've been using that word, I'm really glad, to be vulnerable for themselves and to explore that, it creates a difficult challenge for Helen to deal with.
Scott?
Well, it's not just an issue of someone being able to have intimacy with Helen. The problem is that your husband's having intimacy with everyone else, or at least one other person. And I can't be too creative about this. I mean, so much of the work that I do is trying to help couples recover from an affair. But if somebody doesn't get it, and it's brought to their attention, and they believe that it can go on, and I mean, once, you know, the bottom line is, once, if you're married and your spouse is on a dating site, unless you and he are willing to do some really good renegotiating about what it means to be married, I don't really see any creative way of solving this.
Well,
I think your family is giving you some good feedback, which is this just isn't good for you, and it's not good for the marriage.
Here's my thought, and I agree with both my guests. However, post-divorce, loving him does not have to be conflictual. You can love him and not be married to him. You can love him and not even see him. You can just love this man because you don't have to carry with you any more, you know, fear or resentment or mistrust, because you've got a boundary now. That's his now and not yours. But then you can be more comfortable loving this man.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Well, I'm glad. You take care of yourself.
And that's a great point that you made, Dan.
Yep.
Let's go back to the line. We've got William on the line. William?
Hello there.
Hi.
Yes, I'm here. I'm in my early 40s, and my wife and I have been married for 21 years now. We don't have children. And so my question was, because you're talking about empty nesters, do you find this stage of growing apart happening earlier with those that don't have children, like my wife and I might be in?
Wait a minute, William. You're talking to three psychotherapists here, and we do the questioning.
Oh, okay.
And you do the answering. So is that what's happening in your marriage?
Well, we've been fighting over trying to keep it together. I should say working over the last few years. And so that was kind of my question, because a lot of the symptoms that I hear are happening with those who have been married for a long time, or older, 10 years older than us, sounds like symptoms that we're having, and I'm wondering if it's different because of us not having children, that it's happening sooner.
Let me ask you one more question, and then I'll turn to the real experts here. Do you want to stay married?
Very much so.
And does your wife want to stay married?
I think so.
Okay. So that makes things a bit more clear and easier. So, Rita, let's turn to you.
It sounds to me like the cooperation stage, which is the bulk of what happens in a marriage over time, cooperating around money and children and social and all the different complications and issues of life. And if a couple doesn't attend to those, and children actually do bring couples together and force cooperation, doesn't mean they always get there. But I would say that probably there's a lot of conversation about the important areas of life that needs to be taking place. And even if it's just a checklist at this point, what's happening with us physically, mentally, spiritually, in our social relationships, in our personal relationships, in our dreams for the future, that kind of check-in and that kind of working together and knowing how to resolve conflict. One of the interesting statistics I always find is that two-thirds of couples who divorce are conflict avoidant, which means they don't talk about these core issues, and so consequently, they can never really develop the kind of team skill that will allow them to later on go more deeply into who they are as people and who they are as a couple and what their, hopes are for this time of life.
Scott, I want to turn to you here. There's a lot of statistics about what happens to people post-divorce. And, you look at the numbers and it's not pretty that people are no happier after divorce at this stage of life than before. But
that's correct. And let me just amend something that Rita was saying about redefining where you are in this phase. I've actually used Rita's book and given it to my clients because there's some really good checklists in there. And so something to keep in mind that if you're wondering how do I ask those questions, Rita's made it really clear how to do that. Mm-hmm. Now let me talk for a minute about why it's not such a bad idea to stay married, even though at a certain time you think, oh, is this worth it? We know statistically, first of all, that people that leave marriages, in part because they're unhappy in marriage, that the vast majority of them are no happier. This is a 5-year study. They're no happier after they've departed marriage unless they were victims of domestic violence, or within those 5 years they married somebody else. And now they were saying, now I'm happy. But you have to ask what that would look like years from now. But what we do know, though, is that many people that view themselves in a particular phase of being unhappy in marriage 5 years later will report themselves being happy or very happy in their marriages, even if they're not seeing a therapist. What marriage can provide you, in addition to, we talked earlier about it being better for your children, well, in this case, we're not talking about children, but we're talking about reduced risks for mental illness, increased lifespan, increased financial security, decreased chances of ending up in a nursing home or even staying in the hospital fewer days if you're married versus single. Tremendously reduced risk of suicide in men. Staying married is good for your health.
Even in an unhappy marriage.
Well, it depends on how you define an unhealthy, happy marriage. And this is the crux of the work that Rita and I, and I don't know much about you, Dan, but I'll assume you also, which is that it doesn't have to be an unhappy marriage. There are things that you can do. There are, if you're like Helen and, your husband has perpetually been having affairs, all right, I don't know that there's much you can do. But there are so many people that leave marriage just because they're unhappy, unfulfilled, falling out of love. And so many of these people can get their marriages back on track and have a quality marriage. So I don't think that you have to abandon your marriage because you're not happy. You can get the same health benefits that everybody else has if you start using the skills to have a high quality, fun, happy, and enriching marriage.
And we know now, and Rita touched on it earlier in the show, we know so much more about brain plasticity and resiliency that we haven't even gotten to touch on today's show, that things do change at every stage of life. Unfortunately, Rita, Scott, and listeners, we are just about out of time, and I really want to thank you both. You've been great and shed a lot of light on this difficult subject.
Rita, thanks, Dan.
Thank you, and Scott, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Dan. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to rebroadcast our show on women and leadership as an unbiased observer. It was a great show. So to share your thoughts on today's show, download podcasts. We're at whyy.org/voices. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And I am at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Thank you, sir. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, please enjoy your week, my friends.